Good day and welcome to today's updates on family separation and family reunification. All participants are in a listen-only mode. You will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. It is now my pleasure to turn the call over to Ben Johnson.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for everyone for being on the call. My name is Ben Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and this call has been put together by AILA and by the American Immigration Council in order to provide you all some information about what's happening on the ground with regard to this issue of family separation, family unification. This information, this work that's being presented is part of AILA and the Council's immigration justice campaign. Really a couple of years ago, we launched the immigration justice campaign because under the best of circumstances, the immigration system is often rigged against those people who face deportation. If you're in detention, only about 14% of detained immigrants have an opportunity to talk to a lawyer to understand and represent them and their issues in immigration court. And oftentimes, the system is designed to minimize any kind of meaningful due process and work around fundamental principles of fairness, like having an independent judge looking at cases, having opportunities to be heard, to understand facts and present cases. So as I said, under the best of circumstances, the immigration system just doesn't do that well, and the justice campaign was set up to try to increase the number of people that were represented by counsel. If you don't know, you certainly should be aware of the fact that these are not the best of circumstances. What we have seen, and I think the country's outrage over family separation is justified. I think what we have seen in terms of the willingness of the administration to separate families as a tool of coercion and deterrence has been met with outrage. Again, that is justifiable. But it's also important to understand that this the concept of family separation is really part of a larger effort by the administration to really dramatically change both the rights of immigrants in immigration court, but also the process of asylum. We're not going to have time to really dig into those changes and the broader attack on asylum law and policy, but I would encourage you all to think about this issue in that broader context. AILA has on its webpage a new policy brief that deals with this new USCIS guidance and the new decision by the Attorney General in matter of AB regarding asylum seekers. It was posted just yesterday. If you've got questions about that, we're happy to take those now or in the future, but I do think it's important to understand the context of what's happening here in a broader effort to really completely undermine asylum seekers, those at the border and otherwise. In order to give you a snapshot of what's going on, we've got some people here on the call who have had a firsthand experience and an ongoing experience, certainly in the case of the work that's happening at the Dilley Detention Center, a project that we've been working with partners on for a long time to help those folks that are at that detention center. And I think what you'll find that the picture that will be painted for you by these folks is really one of a consistent pattern of trauma, of coercion, confusion, and really a systematic disregard for the fundamental rights of the folks that have been caught up in this current family separation policy. So I'm going to get out of the way and let the folks who have seen this play out on the ground talk about what they've seen firsthand. We're going to have three people with us here today. The first will be Royce Murray, who is the policy director at the American Immigration Council. After that, we'll have a chance to hear from Shay Fuhardy, who is the managing attorney at the Dilley Pro Bono Project in Dilley, Texas. And then we'll hear from Katie Shepard, who is the National Advocacy Council for the Immigration Justice Campaign. So, Royce, why don't you start us off and talk a little bit about what you've seen and maybe some background on this, where we stand with family separation issues.
And thanks, Ben, for that introduction. Again, this is Royce Murray. I'm the policy director with the American Immigration Council. I'd like to begin by providing an overview of where things stand to make sure folks folks are aware, from ACLU's filing last night in the family separation litigation, the universe of class members and how many have been reunified or remain to be reunified. From that filing, they identified that 2,551 potential class members exist, and that's of children who are ages 5 and over. Of those, they deem 1,634 class members to be eligible for future action. Among those, 879 class members have already been reunified. This is not information I've personally verified, but I'm just reporting out from the filing from last night. 538 more class members have been approved and are pending transportation. And 217 class members, so 217 children, have been released to a sponsor in the interior. The eligibility of 917 other class members of those children are either not known or not eligible, and that's either because parents have waived the right to reunification, quite a number of parents have been already deported per DHS, the Department of Homeland Security. Some have criminal records which the Department of Homeland Security is deeming them ineligible for reunification, and others are pending further evaluation. ACLU has a status hearing at 3 p.m. Pacific today and another one on Friday, so there will be more information. But for those who hadn't seen that filing, I wanted to provide that overview at the outset. Otherwise, I did want to provide our view from the ground, as Ben mentioned. Katie Shepard and I both have been to El Paso. We were there the week before last. We have other colleagues who we passed the baton to this past week and who we're in regular communication with. If you are not aware, El Paso is one of the primary sites where separated parents have been detained, and they are the locations where their children are being brought to for reunification, and then for further action to be taken, either for those families to be released, to be transferred to family detention, or to be staged for deportation. We visited and continue to get updates on primarily three detention facilities in the El Paso area. That's the El Paso Processing Center, Service Processing Center, which is in El Paso, Texas. The Otero Detention Facility, half an hour outside of El Paso in New Mexico. And the West Texas Detention Facility in Sierra Blanca, Texas, which is an hour and a half outside of El Paso. All three of those sites actively hold separated parents for future action to be taken. So I'd like to speak about the releases that we've seen in El Paso. There have been several hundred families getting released in El Paso in recent days. The reunifications are typically happening when a child is brought to the detention center and they are reunified in the parking lot outside of the facility and then taken to a shelter for released families. Virtually all of these parents are getting GPS ankle monitors placed on them from ICE so that their whereabouts are known upon release. Nearly all of these families leave El Paso to continue on to their destination to stay with other family or community support while their immigration proceedings remain ongoing. Our most immediate priority for these released families are that they are all being given check-in times and appointments to return to an ICE office to show that they are complying and with these obligations of supervision. They should be getting these check-ins for 2 weeks out from release, or approximately 2 weeks out, at their place of destination, not their release location, since so many do leave. There have been problems along the way that we continue to hear about, and we remain concerned that their check-ins are being set up for too soon in time, as soon as a week out, and even in their place of release. And so we're going to be monitoring the check-in process very closely because we really want to make sure that these check-ins go well. We are, through the Immigration Justice Campaign, we are identifying pro bono attorneys to accompany families to their check-ins so so they understand their obligations, because these moments of reunification and release are incredibly chaotic, often happening in the middle of the night, and we want to make sure that people understand what their obligations are. We want to make sure that these families are not being set up to fail by giving them confusing information or bad information about where and when they're supposed to appear. So we are working hard on getting, as I mentioned, pro bono attorneys to accompany those families to their check-ins. For the families that remain detained, the parents who remain detained, you know, per the litigation report, there are hundreds of parents who still are in detention. With our partners on the ground in El Paso, the Justice Campaign is trying to reach all of these detainees to better understand why they remain in detention, the status of their case, and to ensure that they have not inadvertently waived any of their rights to reunify with their child or to pursue their asylum case. We do know from that litigation update that among the parents being that continue to be in detention, some have relinquished their rights to reunify with their child and have signed deportation papers. Others are pending other issues. And so we really want to follow up because we have tremendous concerns about parents who have relinquished their right to reunify with their child. We want to ensure that they are not deported without their child if they did not understand that they would have the ability to both fight for their case and reunify with their child. And that's one of our key takeaways from our time, Katie and I both, and she'll talk a bit more, from our interviews with detainees, is there was an utter lack of information that parents had at the time they were making critical, life-threatening, life or death decisions. They were often proceeding with credible fear interviews as part of their asylum process without having spoken to their child, so they were not only fretting with worry about where their child was and whether they would be reunified, impacting, of course, their ability to testify, but they also didn't have the testimony from their children where those children were perhaps teenagers and part of the reason why a family fled. They might have been the target of persecution, and that child was not available to participate in that interview. But generally speaking, with that limited information, with not a single person that we spoke with already had an attorney, and we really had to go looking for these people and find them in detention in order to have these consultations, they were being pressured by ICE to sign papers that it would be the fastest way that they could see their child again, that if they chose to fought their case, they would be kept in detention for many months longer, prolonging their separation from their children. Copies of forms were not provided to these parents. They were often not in Spanish. Parents often did not, they weren't necessarily literate in Spanish, let alone English. And so it's not entirely clear that any of the paperwork signed by these parents was done in a knowing and willful way, given the duress they were under by being separated from their children, and the total lack of information and legal counsel that was available to them at that time. So with that, I will turn it back over to Ben to introduce further speakers.
Thanks so much, Royce. I think now we want to hear from Shay Fluharty, again, the Managing Director at the Dilley Pro Bono Project, who's been on the ground even before this family separation crisis, can talk a little bit about what things look like from there. Shay?
Good morning, everyone. Shaylin Fluharty with the Dilley Pro Bono Project, reporting from the parking lot outside of the South Texas Family Residential Center here in Dilley, Texas. It is a very bizarre time here in Dilley. We, on the ground, have consistently seen very high volumes of families detained here pending interviews with the asylum office. The capacity at the facility here in Dilley is 2,400. We've always been a facility that has provided or received and detained women, mothers with their children, often one child, sometimes more. Currently, the number of people that are detained here in Dilley is very low. We're used to receiving approximately 100 new families a day, somewhere between 70 and 100 families a day. currently, what the families that we are talking with currently are all new families that have arrived to Dilley after being reunited with their children. That said, we are currently only working with 31 families that have been reunited. And these families are coming in very different procedural postures. We have a handful of families who already have notices to appear. In fact, it seems that within their paperwork, they have documents that say that the government has decided to release them. We find this very confusing because they've been reunited within the past couple of days and yet are detained here in Dilley in conflict with what we are seeing with other families who have been released as a family unit. We have families that have final orders of removal. And just to clarify, we have mothers that have final orders of removal. So mothers who have, while they were in detention, alone, separated from their parent, been forced to proceed with an interview in front of the asylum officer. That interview resulted in a negative, credible fear finding. Many of those families had the opportunity to see an immigration judge. Many of them decided to not see an immigration judge because they misunderstood that if they continued to proceed in fighting their case, they might not have the ability to see their child ever again. When we are talking to these families who have negative decisions and are pending removal, it is very apparent to us that the impact and the trauma of being separated from their children created such a significant duress in their process that they were really incapacitated and unable to put forth their claims for asylum. It really seems like a proper analogy would be running a sprint with a broken leg. You know, our families are unable or have been unable to talk about the traumatic events that led to their flight to the United States in search of protection and safety because all that they were consumed by was the safety and well-being of their children who were, for many of the mothers, completely lost. They had no contact with them at all. We also have families that are pending their initial interview with the asylum office who have not yet proceeded in speaking with an asylum officer or detailing their claim for asylum at all prior to being brought here to Dilley. And some families who have had the opportunity to have an interview but who have not yet received a decision from the asylum office. This is the procedural posture of the cases for the mothers, but it's been very challenging for us to actually identify this information. So many of our clients we found do not know who they spoke with, do not know if they have a decision after speaking with an immigration judge or not, do not know if they're pending deportation. So we're spending a lot of time trying to understand what has happened and trying to explain the process to our clients who have never had any access to this really important information. What surprisingly has been even more difficult is trying to figure out the procedural posture of the case of the children. Many of the children and many of the adults of the mothers that we're serving have no documents at all. We are being told that many of them have had their documents taken away from them, that they maybe traveled with those documents and they were taken by the facility or by immigration officials when they arrived to Dilley. For the children who do have paperwork with them, what we are noticing is that all of those children have a document called a notice to appear. And what that means is that they are in or pending removal proceedings in front of an immigration judge. And it's our understanding that that would mean that those children could not be deported from the United States or removed from the United States until they have the opportunity to present their claims to an immigration judge. But this is really sort of this understanding of the law or the idea that a notice to appear served upon an individual means that that individual is in removal proceedings and that only an immigration judge would have authority to authorize their removal is really in direct conflict with some of the things that we are seeing, which has us worried that the government's intention is to deport many of the families that they're bringing here to Dilley. So, for example, the reunited families that we're speaking with, the mothers are telling us that they have been informed that their children cannot enroll in the school that is located here on site in Dilley. And our best guess is that the reason that they're not allowing them to enroll in school is because they believe they will not be here for very long. And so as an attorney trying to provide services to this very vulnerable population, you know, my first inquiry is, what is the posture of this individual's case? What legal services do they need? And that has been a very difficult question to determine as a lawyer serving the mothers and also serving the children. The other tremendous impediment that we're having to providing meaningful access to legal information and meaningful legal services is just this palpable trauma that our mothers and our children are arriving with. We cannot engage in conversations with our client that have anything to do with the idea or possibility of separation, because the children and the parents completely crumble in tears. This type of conversation, which is one that is important to have because we have children, we believe, who are in removal proceedings in front of an immigration judge, and parents who we believe through very unfair processes are sitting with final orders of deportation. And so we need the opportunity to explain what this might mean to our families and to engage conversations with them so that they can give us direction as lawyers about some of these very difficult choices. And these topics are conversations that our clients are really unable to engage in based upon this very real trauma that they have survived after being separated from their children. The other thing that we found really hard is that, you know, the underlying asylum case for many of our parents involves very significant past trauma, including rape, forced slavery, ongoing physical harm, threats of death, and that many of those facts are facts that our parents know, and facts that impact not only their safety in their home country, but also the safety of their children. And so some of the questions that our parents have been presented with in the past are this question of being with their children or keeping their child safe. And it seems very clear to us from our conversations with our parents, with our mothers, that their expressed desire is to ensure the safety of their children and also to be with their children to ensure their safety. We have stories of mothers who have expressed to us not even recognizing their child at the time of reunification because their children had lost so much weight. We are hearing daily stories from mothers who are learning about what has happened to their child while they have been outside of their care. And so these decisions are really impossible decisions for our clients to make at this time while they are unpacking such traumatic circumstances in the moment and are faced with what seem to us to be very difficult decisions. So we are working hard to try to ensure that our clients understand what is happening, but as lawyers providing services to this population, we also feel like we are very much in the dark. We have made requests to the government in writing to provide us immediately with copies of any removal orders that they have for the children, any charging documents that they have for the children, and any documents that would explain the authority that they have to detain the children here in Dilley. And to date, we have not received a response from ICE, from Immigration and Customs Enforcement. We do not know at this time if we should be expecting hundreds of families to arrive here together with an intention on behalf of the government to deport them quickly. We know that we are not alone here on the ground. We have many volunteers that are here standing beside us to ensure that these families have as much access to representation as they deserve. But the circumstances are very, very challenging. I think the last thing that I will mention is that it is not as easy to access our clients as we would like it to be. For example, yesterday we had requested to speak with a client, and the client did not show up to our meeting until 5 to 6 hours late. In this particular moment in time when every hour seems to count, those types of delays are really impacting our ability to provide crucial information to these very vulnerable families who are going through a very, very difficult time.
Thank you, Shay. Now, Katie Shepherd, who again is the National Advocacy Council for the Immigration Justice Campaign. Katie?
Thanks, Ben, and thank you, Shay and Royce. So I wanted to start by sharing a couple of updates as to what is going on in Carnes, the kind of sister family detention center down the road from Dilley, located in Carnes City. As of late last night, there are 55 reunified families currently in Carnes, and this would be all fathers with their minor children. And then there are also 27 or 28 single adult women who are not Miss L class members. We believe that ICE simply ran out of bed space, and we have also we understand that these women will be transferred by the end of the week, most likely to Port Isabel. Also, we understand that about 500 parents are remain detained in the El Paso area and are waiting to be transferred, most likely to Dilley and Carnes, and for the purposes of being reunified with their children. And then I wanted to turn back to the issue of coercion, which both Royce and Shay spoke about a little bit. The multiple layers of coercion that the vast majority, if not all, of the separated parents that we met with in the El Paso area was truly astounding. As Royce said, they were being asked to sign paperwork that they did not understand because they do not read or write. They were generally not given a chance to ask any questions, and they were told that, you know, by signing this paperwork, they would be reunified with their children more quickly. In essence, the government is holding hundreds of children hostage throughout this process. These consistent reports from the ground really represent a wholesale disregard for due process and the legal protections enshrined in the Constitution. And, of course, it's very disconcerting because we know that many of these families fled to the United States seeking humanitarian relief and safety from harm back in their countries of origin. I also wanted to speak a little bit about the fact that family detention is not a reasonable alternative to the policy of family separation. Ostensibly, the families who are being transferred to Dilley and Carnes are in a better situation because they have been reunified with their parents. And there are teams of attorneys on the ground in both Dilley and Carnes, with Shay leading up the Dilley Pro Bono Project in Dilley, and Rices with a team on the ground in Carnes. But the fact remains is that family detention is not an appropriate setting for vulnerable asylum seekers, and certainly not for this particularly traumatized population of families who had been previously separated. The trauma that occurs at the time of separation is irreparable and is very apparent based on the accounts we are hearing from the ground. In the El Paso area, we are hearing accounts of children who have head lice, who are wearing dirty clothes and are unwashed at the time that they are reunified with their parents. We have also heard reports that children have lost so much weight during the time of separation to make them almost unrecognizable to their parents. In short, the administration is presenting us with a false choice, suggesting that family detention is an appropriate or humane alternative to family separation, a policy devised and implemented by the government for the purposes of exerting maximum cruelty and suffering for the so as to deter future migrants from fleeing north. However, of course, there is this third option called Alternatives to Detention, or ATDs. Parents wearing ankle monitors and released with their children are permitted to fight their cases in a non-detained setting. Then, of course, there is the Family Case Management Program, which was halted last June of 2017, and had a success rate of over 99% in terms of attending immigration court hearings and also going to ICE check-ins.
Bottom line, alternatives to detention are much more humane, less costly, and as efficient as both family detention and, of course, family separation. And now I will turn it back over to Ben for any questions. Thanks so much.
All right. So we do want to open up for questions. I do want to just reemphasize what Katie just talked about, which is family detention. What you've heard from all of this is that in a detained setting, the families continue to have the threat of separation, the coercive threat of separation hung over their heads. And I also want to point to the fact that the current environment where the Attorney General has attempted to categorically deny the asylum claims of these claimants through a matter of AB and otherwise, the opportunity to talk to experts on what the posture of those cases simply and to be able to fight those cases fully simply does not exist in that detained setting. I've been doing this 25 years, and day to day I can't quite tell you what exactly is the right response to the Attorney General's determination that anybody who's claiming domestic violence or gang-related violence from the Northern Triangle should have their claim dismissed. That is an incredibly difficult situation. It's one that requires these folks to be out on alternatives to detention and have an opportunity to have their cases reviewed. All right, that being said, let's open this up to questions and find out where people want more information. Operator?
And at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. You may remove yourself from the queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, that's star and one to ask a question. We'll pause for a moment to allow questions to queue. And your first question comes from Matt McDonald with The Wall Street. Your line is open.
Hi, all. Thank you for arranging this call and giving up that information. I just have a question about some of the numbers that came in. I see that 463 parents separated from their children either have been deported or their whereabouts are unknown. Do we know what's going to happen next for these parents or you know, what the next steps for them and their attempts to reunify with their children?
Roy, since you got those numbers, you want to take that?
Sure. I mean, we're very concerned. That's a very high number of parents who cannot be located or who already have been deported. I think that'll be one of the next steps in the litigation is to try to break down that number. For DHS should know who they have deported, so for us to get a clear sense of how many of those have been deported or how many are separately, whose whereabouts are not known, or who, you know, where there's been bad record keeping between DHS and its component agencies as far as who was, you know, what happened when the child was separated from those parents. So I think the next steps are unclear. I think there should be a lot of pressure placed on the department to shrink that number to zero. You know, they should be seeking to bring back parents or at a minimum communicate with those parents to identify what the parents' desires would be to reunify those families and where those parents are not, their whereabouts are not known. We need to make sure they're working as hard as possible to find them.
Okay.
This is
Thank
Ben.
You.
I would also just say, yeah, we have deep concern. Based on what we've seen with the folks that we've talked to, the stories that have been portrayed you know, by the folks on this call, there seems just to be an incredibly high likelihood that those removals themselves were based on either coercion, misinformation that was communicated to them, or the Attorney General's, you know, we think tenuous and impermissible determination that these asylum claims or these credible fear interviews should be denied, as a, you know, sort of categorically. So, on many, many grounds, it seems to me that those removals are suspect, and we're certainly going to do everything that we can, working with the ACLU and others, to determine what rights were denied and what remedies are available.
Thank you.
And your next question comes from Suzanne Gamboa with NBC News. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for having the call. I was wondering if you could just tell me a little bit more about school. Would they usually enroll there? Would that be happening now? Is your expectation that they should be doing that now? Just could you just kind of flesh that out a little bit more? Thanks.
Sure. So, yes, typically when families arrive here to Dilley, one of the first things that happen within days after arrival is they are registered with the on-site school, which I understand is like a chartered subcontractor at the facility. We have been told through our clients that the mothers have been informed that they cannot register their children for school. We don't, unfortunately, have any additional information than that, but what we can confirm is that is 100% different than what has always happened here for every other family.
And do you know, is it happening for some, not others?
My understanding is that's what's happening for every family that's been reunited.
So aren't there families there that are not reunited families? I mean, are there, or is it just the reunited families that are there?
No, we still have families that have been here going through the credible fear interview process that are still awaiting their decision results and release, or at least that's what we have always seen here in Dilley. So the most recent numbers that I had heard in terms of total population was about 700 individuals, but that, you know, every day the numbers change here, so those numbers are probably already outdated. And we are not receiving any new families. So our understanding is that families who might be apprehended at the border now are not being sent to detention, that they are being released immediately with notices to appear and not being placed in the expedited removal process.
So some of those 700 there, are their children enrolling in school?
Yes, their children are attending school.
Thanks.
And your next question comes from Amy Texan with AP. Your line is open.
Thanks so much. I just want to see if you could specify a little bit more about what the paperwork is that the families, the separated parents signed. Have you been able to actually find out what this paperwork is? Is it expedited removal orders? Is it, you know, not getting a review of their credible fear hearing? Just any specifics would be helpful, and how widespread it is.
Hi there. This is Katie from the council. So all of the parents that we met with in the El Paso area over a week ago did sign paperwork that they were not given copies of, and it is actually unclear to us what the forms were that they signed because, as I said, they were not given copies. We do understand that there were, at a minimum, two different versions of the forms that they were signing, possibly to reflect the developments in the litigation that's ongoing. But the bottom line is we really don't know. We did hear consistently from the parents that they were given, you know, two or three options, which was to be removed from the United States with their children, to be removed but leave their children stateside here in the U.S., or to fight their asylum cases. However, on the third point, most of the people we spoke with were told by ICE officers or guards or both that if they insisted on fighting their asylum claims, that they would be detained for 6 to 8 months and that they would not see their children during the time of detention, and that they would invariably lose and be deported with their children after they lost their cases. Importantly, they were not given the option, or they were not informed that they had the option of both fighting their asylum claims and being reunited, which is one of the protections put forth by the Miss L litigation.
And we're trying to get access to some of those documents, but this, you know, speaks to what I mentioned as the sort of the challenges of the immigration system more generally, and that is that there isn't the same discovery rights in immigration proceedings that there are in other typical legal proceedings. So we have to rely on Freedom of Information Act requests in order to get access to a lot of this information, which not surprisingly takes, as you all know better than most, how long that can take. So again, this is a circumstances where the whole system seems to be engineered towards speed, The opportunity to understand what these people signed, what happened to them, what the posture of their case is all moving on a much slower track than the agency's removal proceedings are moving.
The only other thing that I'll say in response to the question about the paperwork is, in addition to these waivers, many of our families were issued, our mothers were issued negative credible fear determinations. And when that decision is typically issued, on the bottom of the first form, the applicant has the opportunity to choose to have an immigration judge review the negative decision of the asylum officer. And we have a number of families who have chosen not to have their decision reviewed because, as Katie was mentioning, they were under the impression that if they continued to fight their case, they would never see their children again. And the other thing that we've noticed, which is, I think, different than some of the experiences that Katie may be seeing in El Paso, is that many of the families or mothers and children that we are speaking with previously had the opportunity to work with an attorney, but that access was very spotty, or perhaps didn't even happen until days before they were transferred to Dilley. And so one of the things that we're trying to do is contact lawyers all over the country whose clients were moved away from them really overnight. Many of the lawyers who were engaging in representation in the past have been unable to contact the clients who have now been moved to Dilley, may have information that the individuals who are here in Dilley desperately need to access. And so there's been an access to counsel challenge on that end as well that we're trying to navigate as we're trying to provide services to the families that really need them while they're here.
Next question.
And your next question comes from Pilar Marrero with LA Opinion Newspaper. Your line is open.
Hi. Yes, Pilar Marrero from La Opinion. In regards to, are there reunified families that are still in detention and not released? And what are the reasons why they're not released?
So, Royce or Katie, you want to talk about what we've seen, the sort of inconsistency and.
So I can. This is Royce. I'm happy to talk on the larger point, which is the one lesson that we have learned from all of these cases is that there is barely a pattern among them. Their cases are being released at a variety of stages of the process, and likewise, there are cases of parents that remain detained in a variety of stages of the process. I can let Shay speak to the cases in Dilley, but if Katie wants to mention anything about her understanding from Carnes or otherwise.
I did just want to share, this is Katie, to add to what Royce just shared, is that that's right. We're seeing a lot of parents be released to the community and being reunified with their children at various stages of their legal case, which in short order means that many people are now in the community with negative decisions. Not because they don't have a credible fear of return to their country, but very likely because they didn't have counsel present and were not adequately prepared for the interviews. So these people are very vulnerable and are essentially sitting ducks to being later apprehended and detained by DHS in the future.
But Shay, can you speak to the pattern in what you're seeing in detention of the posture of cases?
Sure. So, you know, one thing that's been really confusing for us is we either don't have paperwork or we have paperwork that seems inconsistent and we don't have answers from the government regarding their stance in a particular family or individual's case. So as I was mentioning, we have some clients who have been transferred here to Dilley who have signed orders of release on their own recognizance, which is typically the paperwork that Immigration and Customs Enforcement would give to someone who is being released. And so that might be paperwork that
a family who, let's say, was reunited in El Paso and have been released would have. But we have families that have been reunited and then brought to Dilley with some of that paperwork. And, you know, we're guessing, but our guess could be that they were brought to Dilley by accident, even though the government made a decision to release them, or perhaps they made a decision to release them and gave them the paperwork saying as much and then changed their mind. And so that's one thing that I think is an ongoing question and mystery for us here on the ground. The other thing that I think is important to mention is that this facility here in Dilley continues to be an unlicensed, secure facility that doesn't have a child care license at all. And so we, in the past, because of the requirements of the Flores settlement, have seen the government release families here in Dilley every time a positive decision was issued on their case. We have no reason to believe that that won't continue to happen, but in this new uncertain time, we're not quite sure that we can make any type of assurances to our clients regarding if or when they'll be released from the facility in Dilley.
Thanks, Shay. Next question.
And your next question comes from Yeganya Torvati with Reuters. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you all so much for doing this call. I just had one quick clarification and then a substantive question. The clarification for Royce, could you just rename? You said there's three sites that actively hold separated parents, and you went through those names. I just didn't catch those, if you could repeat those. And then the substantive question for anyone who wants to answer it is, if you're seeing an uptick in credible fear denials either at the interview stage since the July 11th memo went out to asylum officers, and then also when you get a denial and you go to an immigration judge, if you're seeing immigration judges be more willing or I should say less willing to overturn or vacate a negative determination. Thank you.
Thanks for your questions. I can clarify on the sites. So in the El Paso area, there are three detention facilities. They are the El Paso Service Processing Center, the Otero Detention Facility in New Mexico, but just outside of El Paso, and the West Texas Detention Facility, which is in Sierra Blanca, Texas. Now, those are just the facilities in El Paso. There are other primary relocation facilities in the United States, elsewhere in Texas and Arizona, but those were the three in the El Paso area that have seen a lot of activity. On the CFI question, I can turn it over to Shay, who handles CFIs more regularly.
I think the answer would be we're waiting to see, and that we've noticed just throughout the entirety of our time here in Dilley, that the outcome of someone's case is almost 100% determined by who they're presenting their claim to, more specifically, which asylum officer and which asylum office supervisor is adjudicating their claim. And so that makes it difficult, I think, at times to really identify the causal link and trends, because many of the asylum officers who are here in Dilley and the supervisors in Dilley are usually here for two-week details. And so we consistently see changes and fluctuations regarding adjudications based in large part on what population of asylum officers are here on the ground and who the asylum office supervisors are for any two-week period of time. That said, we have certainly seen an uptick in negative decisions since the matter of AB was decided. We do not yet have much intel regarding interviews that have happened after the USCIS memo occurred, but what we can say is that when we have been in front of the immigration judge, we have heard immigration judges interpret matter of AB in a way that seems very different from at least our understanding of the decision. And so, for example, we've had immigration judges tell us in court that after matter of AB, no asylum case can be granted using the protected ground of particular social group at all, which is just not in alignment with what the decision actually found. But what we have seen is that judges pretty much are dismissing any particular claim that's based on a particular social group formulation, both when that formulation has to do with some sort of domestic violence-related fact pattern, but also when it's connected to very different types of thought patterns of violence.
Thanks, Shay. And for other folks on the call, I would just point out that, you know, what Shay's talking about in that context is, you know, involves an immigration judge, but it does, that involves a credible fear determination, which is not a full exploration of the case. So these are, you know, determinations made by IJs, but based on presentation of the case by the person seeking asylum without the benefit of counsel being there and without a complete presentation of all the facts. Anyway, next question.
And your next question comes from Kate Marissi with San Diego Union. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I also had one clarification and then one question. I was wondering, with the 99% success rate for the ATD program, if there's a particular report or place where I can look to get more information about that. And then for my actual question, if you could talk a little bit more about what's happening with families who are arriving now and what kind of processing we're seeing with them. Do they still get credible fear interviews when they are not detained at Dilley, or how does that work?
Hi, Kate. This is Katie. So on your first point regarding information on the FCMP, the Family Case Management Program, the Women's Commission, the Women's Refugee Commission actually just released a backgrounder, I think a couple of weeks ago, that has all the information that you'll need. And on this second point, we only encounter families who are detained, so cross the border and then are transferred to family detention, or separated and placed in adult detention facilities. So presumably the remainder are released with ankle monitors and permitted to continue fighting their cases in a non-detained setting. But that category of people don't generally have to do fear interviews with the asylum office before being able to continue fighting their claims for asylum.
And just to follow up on that, my information from conversations with government officials is that during this period of time between now and the deadline for family reunification, through the MISL order, newly arriving families, my understanding is that they will be released in large part because there isn't capacity to do something different.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the best information will come from the government on this. It's hard for us to have transparency in real time. But if families are being released, they are often put, as Katie mentioned, on an ankle monitor and not subjected to expedited removal at that point, but rather kept in more standard immigration court proceedings. You know, they're given a charging document that explains the date and time when they are supposed to appear before an immigration judge in the future.
Yeah, but I mean, my colleagues will correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think the other wild card in this scenario is the willingness of the Trump administration to prosecute asylum seekers for unlawful entry. So some of these folks are finding themselves in criminal court and in some cases criminal detention facilities at the beginning of this process, and it's not clear how that is exactly playing itself out and what's happening to them when they're released. Is that an accurate statement, folks?
I think, Ben, you're absolutely right that that was the case for all of the families that we had met with. It's my understanding that that is suspended for the time being in terms of prosecuting families, but
for
certainly
families,
the but the prosecution of asylum seekers who attempt to enter the United States outside of a port of entry, those prosecutions do indeed continue, just not for families for the time being.
Thank you.
Next question.
And your next question comes from Jason Book with Freelance Reporter. Your line's open.
Yeah, y'all, I think, addressed this in response to Pilar's question, but I just wanted to follow up and make sure I understood it. The families in Dilley and Karn, you anticipate that they're going to be released within 20 days, like families, you know, that normally are processed through there, but no one's been in there long enough? None of the reunified families have been in there long enough for y'all to know that for sure? Am I understanding that right?
I was going to defer to Shay to answer that first.
Yeah, Shay.
Yes, I think that's correct, but we have not seen them long enough to know what's going to happen next.
Right. It's also safe to say we have, you know, deep concerns that the administration might try to turn these facilities into just sort of holding locations for ultimate, you know, expedited or a faster removal. Is that right?
Yes, I think that's also right.
And the question of, there's been a proposal by the DOJ in the San Diego case to give families the option to waive their rights under Flores, but nobody's, their kids' rights under Flores, but nobody's being presented with that at Dilley or Karn. You're not.
No, that has not currently come up with us here on the ground, but I do think that we're watching the court filings very closely and feel uncertain about what might happen next here in Dilley.
Okay, thank you.
And your next question comes from Suzanne Gamboa with NBC News. Your line is open.
My question was kind of along the same lines of, since there really is only 20 days, again, the enrolling in school almost seems like, I'm not sure why that's something that you would want them, I mean, that is necessary, except that maybe you just think they're going to be there longer. And then also, I was kind of confused by your statement about the child care licensing. If they're not, they don't have a child care license, I don't understand how the kids are there. Is that not a violation of state law? Or can you just explain that a little bit more?
Sure. I'm confused, too, about how any of these children are here. The Flores settlement is clear that children can only be placed in licensed facilities, and the facility in Dilley, the facility in Karnes, and the Family Residential Center in Berks all remain unlicensed. The settlement does not provide, for example, the ability to place kids in a facility even for a short period of time, like even for 20 days. It would be a violation of the settlement to have someone in an unlicensed facility for that long. And so this is a confusion that we have long pondered here in Dilley, how kids are here at all. Back to the question regarding the school, even though families traditionally have been here for 20 days, we significantly see families that are here for much longer time than that. For example, we've had families that have been here for over 2 months before they were released. And during that period of time, access to education is actually really important. The Flores settlement also details what sorts of services and provisions are required for children while they're in detention, and access to education is one of them. The other thing that I think is important to note is that, you know, the trauma that these families are carrying is extremely, it's extremely intense, and it's very heavy. And anything that we can do to help these children be children and to give them any sort of feeling of normalcy is really important as they're trying to readjust to another very traumatic circumstance that's happening live, which is being detained right now with the looming question of if or when they will be deported and if or when they will face once again the very dangerous circumstances for which they fled initially. And so, you know, I think what's alarming to us is a very drastic shift in how these children are being treated at the facility, and it leads us to believe or question whether or not the government intends to rapidly remove these children with their parents, even though the children have not been given any due process to have their underlying claims adjudicated. They haven't been given interviews or placed in credible fear proceedings, and they also have not yet seen a judge in removal proceedings. And so we are really holding our breath to see what will happen next, and unfortunately have been ill-equipped to provide meaningful information to our clients because we don't understand what the government plans to do or believes that they can do and whether or not their intentions comply with the law.
Thanks. Operator, how many more questions we have in the queue?
There are four more questions in queue.
All right, let's try to move through those. I'm mindful of the time here, but let's try to get through those. Folks should know that we will be a recording of this, so we'll have that available for folks if it's a clarification issue. You should be able to get that with the recording. But let's take these next four questions.
And your next question comes from Susan Ferris with the Center for Public Integrity. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for this call. I wanted to ask you if you could elaborate more on this 6-hour delay being able to see clients. Is this something that's happening elsewhere that you've heard of? And do you see it as part of a pattern? Is it unusual? And also just the credible fear interviews, my understanding is those take place in the initial processing. And if you can just, you know, explain that a little bit more.
Sure. Shay, you want to talk a little bit about that 6-hour? I think that was you that brought that up.
Yeah, happy to. So, you know, I think one important consideration is that when families initially arrive here, there's a number of steps that they are required to proceed through. So they see medical, they go through intake, they are informed of the way the facility works and other protocols or avenues for them to get the help that they might need, things like when can you, you know, when are meals available, that sort of stuff. And so when a family initially gets to the facility, there could be delay in our access to them based upon that very typical trajectory. But there are other reasons why, you know, we might be waiting for hours to see a client. So maybe they don't know where our client is located. Maybe our client is receiving urgent medical care and was taken to the hospital. Maybe our client is sitting and waiting for medical care and they've been waiting for 5 hours to see someone and haven't been able to see someone yet. Maybe they've, you know, there could be sort of any number of things that could happen. Maybe the facility just hasn't gotten around yet to letting our client know that we want to meet with them. I would say, generally speaking, here in Dilley, we have significantly more access to meet with clients than individuals who are detained at adult facilities may have. So it's not uncommon for a lawyer to go to a facility and wait 6 or more hours to see their clients when there are facilities with many people that need access to legal services but very limited space in which to meet with a client. We experience that space problem here in Dilley. We don't often have enough private confidential spaces to meet with clients, but this delay in just getting a client into the room with us is one that we have typically seen limitedly, but in this circumstance, we're extremely sensitive to these delays because it's unclear to us if the government intends to use Dilley as a staging facility to simply remove these families promptly. And if that was the circumstance, 6 hours would be extremely detrimental to having access to our clients to provide really important information.
And then as to the credible fear, just, you know, very quickly, you know, that credible fear hearing, that standard is supposed to be just a preliminary determination on whether, you know, by statute it says the individual has to show that there is a significant possibility that the individual could establish eligibility for asylum in a full hearing. It's not meant to be a full hearing. It is meant to just be a screening process for the probability of being able to present a credible claim for asylum in front of a judge at a full hearing. The danger, obviously, is that the Attorney General, through their confusing policy memos, appears to be trying to if not raise the bar, then certainly muddy the waters, particularly on this very complicated, very confusing issue of a particular social group, which is one of the grounds for asylum. I encourage anybody here to read that memo and see if they could articulate a particular social group a standard. And the idea that folks are going to have to figure out how to articulate a claim in this confusing environment, I think, is a real challenge. All the more reason for these processes to be resolved, particularly when the stakes are so high, outside of custody rather than inside a detention center. Anyway, I hope that helps.
Ben, this is Royce. I would just flag that the American Immigration Council has two fact sheets on our website. One is on asylum in the United States, and another is on is called a primer on expedited removal, if you'd like more information about how the process is supposed to work.
Yeah, and just to briefly mention, here in Dilley, the credible fear interviews typically happen here on site with asylum officers who are here in person, and so somebody would cross the border, be issued an expedited order of removal during processing in a CBP station, or even sometimes in URSLA, the Central Processing Center, would assert a fear of return or intention to apply for asylum and then be transferred to Dilley, placed here with their child, and typically at that point would be scheduled for an interview with an asylum officer, which would typically take place about a week after arrival here at the facility. All of the children that we have met, none of them have ever had interviews with an asylum officer. None of them, to our knowledge, have been placed in expedited removal proceedings. None of them have ever been scheduled for credible fear interviews, and all of them have notices to appear, which we believe have not yet been filed with any immigration court.
Wow. Okay. Thank you.
And your next question. Your next question comes from Mike Hong with World Journal. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you. I would like to know that all the families separated at the borders are from Central and Southern American countries, or is there any from other parts of the world, such as China, Asian countries, or the African countries so far, do you know?
This is Royce. I can say, only speak to those that we've seen in El Paso. There were families from Brazil among the families who were otherwise from places like Honduras, Guatemala, and I understand El Salvador. I can't speak to the other families unless Shay has seen other things in Dilley.
Sure. We also have families from the Democratic Republic of Congo.
So far there's no families from Asia, as you know, right?
Not that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
And your question. And your final question comes from Emily Gogolak. She is the freelance writer. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks so much for your time. I have two quick questions. My first is, in Dilley, where are the immigration judges sitting? I assume it's via televideo.
Yes, the Pearsall Immigration Court currently has administrative control of our immigration court proceedings, and they all occur by video teleconference. Interestingly enough, we've been docketed through the Pearsall Immigration Court to appear in front of judges that are not located within sort of the jurisdiction of the Pearsall or San Antonio Immigration Courts, for example. We've been docketed before an immigration judge in New York in the recent past, and we've been docketed in front of an immigration judge at the Port Isabel Detention Center as well.
And my last question is, so are families who are presently at Dilley who are not the families who have been reunified, are those families being released daily?
I'm sorry, Emily, did you say are they being released?
Yes, the families who are not the reunified families, the families who are kind of like the families who would have typically been at Dilley, are they still being released on a daily or semi-daily basis?
To our knowledge, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you all. I think that concludes this. As I said before, there will be a recording of this available that I think will get circulated to folks. We are going to try to judge your ongoing interest in this and availability of information and explore the possibility of more regular updates. Again, I think it's incredibly important to know that family separation is part of a much larger puzzle of how the administration is handling these cases, where there are and the environment of coercion and chaos and confusion that is exists around these families. I certainly hope that we can continue to raise awareness about the fact that these challenges didn't begin with family separation, and they're not going to end with family unification. This represents an ongoing assault on the rights and remedies of these folks in these proceedings, and would certainly be interested in continuing to take questions from all of you about those issues. So thank you all very much for participating, and we look forward to getting back with you soon.